Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-.
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello, it's Matt McLaughlin from Living History here. Before we get started on this week's podcast, some really exciting news for all our UK listeners. Now that the borders between France and Britain have opened up, we've launched a range of tours. We've launched Matt McLaughlin Battlefield Tours in the UK. So now if you're in the UK, you can travel to France, you can tour those battlefields of the Western Front where men fought and died during the Great War. So we've got great tours, we've got weekends that explore all the battlefields, a special tour for Remembrance Day. There's a whole range of great group and private tours there available now for you to travel on. So they're all escorted by Pete Smith, who you would know from our Battle Walks podcast. He's an absolute expert. He lives on the battlefields of the Somme, and he knows this better than anyone else. He's the perfect person to travel the battlefields with. They're going to be a great range of tours. I'm really excited. So jump on our website, check them out, book them now. It's battlewalks.co.uk, and you can book those tours today.
I'm Peter Hart.
And I'm Gary Bain.
And together we're Pete and Gary's Military History
Podcast. Hello and welcome to the podcast. I'm
Hello.
Gary Bain.
Hello, hello.
And I'm here once more with the wonder that is Peter Hart.
I wonder why.
We all wonder why, Pete. That's why you're a wonder. Now today, Pete, we're going to continue with the story of the Battle of the Somme.
Not a one-day battle, then.
Not a one-day battle. This surrounds the activities beyond the 14th of July, which was the night attack that we covered in an earlier podcast.
Yeah, the night attack was quite a success. It had smashed open on in the southern sector the German second line system. It's a bit of a false dawn, wasn't it? It's quite cruel in a way. You get your hopes up and then they're smashed back down again. Do you think they really learned the lessons from the success of the 14th of July?
No, I mean there is a question whether the lessons that should have been learnt, such as, you know, the devastating use of massed artillery, for example, in support of an attack on a wide front, and using more imaginative infantry tactics, whether they'd actually deliberately
cast it to the winds.
They replaced it with tactics which I've seen you describe in one of your books, Pete, as the tactics of the lunatic asylum.
Yeah, I was not politically correct. No. You mean, yes, as if they were nutters. Do you see, if this is a learning curve, then it's a bloody strange, funny, wobbly, wibbly learning curve, isn't it?
A sad travesty of geometry.
Oh, you're so intellectual.
Yes, I wonder where I got that from.
From that bit, I've just seen it written down there. Now, so what the fighting does, it degenerates into the very worst sort of attritional fighting. And you get obscure villages, woods, even trenches that sort of send misery to the hearts of various parts of England and the rest of the empire. Some places that I'm thinking of, one we're not covering today, but things like Mametz Wood, there are still awful memories of that now, sort of 100 years later.
You know, some that we are covering today, things like Delville Wood, that still resonates in South Africa even today.
Well, let's get on with that one then first. So that's the first one. We can't do all of it, can we? Because this is a huge battle, and we're covering the high summer months, at back end of July and into August, and even into September we're covering. So what we've done is just pick three examples, haven't we? And you've just led us into the first one. Delville Wood, we'll put some maps up, or our map up. So what are they trying to do in Delville Wood?
Well, the British are struggling to capture and hold the blighted wood and the ruins of the adjoining village, I think called Longueval, Pete. Is that correct pronunciation? Now, in peacetime, this was 156-acre wood, and it had a typically sylvan aspect with mingled oaks and birch trees, lovely, interspersed with thickets of hazel and undergrowth.
Ooh. It was cut through with what they call, well, I don't know what they call it, them in rides, in they call them rides in this country, but basically cut through breaks, like fire breaks between the trees. And state is it in by mid-July? Is it still lovely?
Yeah, by mid-July, it's ripped to pieces, smashed into tangled heaps by the shells, and it was known as the Devil's Wood, as the troops unsurprisingly called it.
Well, see, the name sort of gives it...
It does, and it presented a fearsome prospect.
Now, on 15th of July, the 9th Division, they'd captured most of Longueville on the 14th of July, the battle we did in the last podcast on the Somme. Now, they're given the task of completing the capture of Delville Wood. And no one really could have guessed how long this was going to take. Who's ordered to do it?
Well, the South African Brigade ordered to capture the wood, and it's an interesting phrase, at all costs. And the attack went in at 06:15 on the 15th of July.
Yes, it's a strange thing. It made you ponder. First, they ordered to attack it at all costs. Later on, to defend it at all costs.
Yeah, it's an. What does it mean? Does it mean to the last man? And in which case, if you're defending it, doesn't that mean it's a failure because you lose it? And do the Germans do such things?
The Germans did tend to hold their front lines to the last man, and then counterattack. And that's one of the reasons they're. Casualties are so high because they have this at all costs. Later on, when they have defence in depth, that they're more likely to pull back.
The French seem to have the most sensible approach to it.
Yeah, retreat if you're in trouble, reorganise, bring up your reserves, and then counterattack.
Yeah. Now, I'm going to be Private Hugh Mallet of the Hugh Mallet.
And your attack goes in at 06:15 on the 15th of July. And your Hugh Mallet, as you said, 2nd Battalion South African Regiment. What's going to happen?
We arrived at the edge of the wood at about dawn, everybody on tenterhooks. And just as the last man got in, old Fritz opened fire with big and little guns, rifle and machine gun fire. What a time we had. Our men were being rolled over like ninepins. But on went the boys, and by 8:30 we had accomplished our task. We gave old Fritz the time of his life. I took a slow and steady aim and made every shot tell. My only regret was that I did not get my bayonet into him. Later, there was a lull, and it was during this lull that I was hit. I was on guard at the time, and it was my duty to keep a sharp lookout over the parapet. I'd only been on a few minutes when old Fritz sent a huge shell right in front of our trench. It blew away a portion of the trench and knocked a tree over on top of us. One of the splinters of the shell landed me one on the right cheek, which of course put me out for a few moments. It made a nasty hole. I did not wish to leave, but I was told to take another wounded man into safety.
That's pretty good. So they managed to capture all but the northwest sort of corner of the wood. But then what would the Germans do? Well, we've talked about this time and time again, and I just reference it. What do the Germans do? What do the Germans do, Gary?
Well, they're going to counterattack, Pete. And not only do they counterattack, but they're increasing in severity. And it's from all around this now developing salient. And almost every available man was needed to repel them over the next 4 days.
So the South Africans try and dig trenches around the perimeter. What problem? Well, you're a practical man. I'm not. What problems can you picture if you're trying to dig in around the edges of a wood?
Well, we mentioned what state the wood was in earlier, so it's no small task with ground that's filled with twisted roots and the mangled trees. The South Africans were there ordered to hold their ground, as you mentioned, at all costs. So inspirational orders are undoubtedly easier to give out than to follow. Now, the German shells, they're raking across the wood, and the ceaseless roar gradually increases in volume as more and more guns were brought up to the line. Now, you're going to be Private Frank Marilia of the 2nd Battalion South African Regiment, which is Natal and Free State.
Absolute hell turned inside out. I never expected to get out whole. Shells dropping everywhere. We get orders to return in the afternoon. Late, I think. In fact, I'm almost sure that our lives were saved when a very brave officer, Captain Hoptroff, made his way to our position. He wasted no time. "Get out!" he said, and was almost immediately hit by a bullet and killed outright. It is strange how, in the most urgent and tragic circumstances, one notices things of minor importance. For as Captain Hoptroff dropped, my eye caught sight of his very beautiful gold wristlet watch, and I have never ceased to regret that I did not take it off and send it to his family. I'm sure that they would have appreciated it. Now, of course, you and your comrades would probably have had a different reason for having their eye on the wristwatch.
Well, and I have no doubt that that happened on occasion. That's a very noble sentiment that Frank Marilia has.
He's a good lad. Now, just to give an idea of the scale, on 18th of July, during these days while the South Africans are defending the wood, it's been calculated around 20,000 shells fall on a single square mile of the devil's wood. At a crescendo, there's 7 per second crashing down. Now, can you imagine that? I mean, I find it difficult to imagine.
No, I think it's almost impossible to imagine that.
So what do you think it's like in the wood?
Well, I mean, all around the perimeter, the young, and they are young, African officers, are recognising the truth that human courage alone can't withstand huge quantities of high explosive and shrapnel. The South Africans, they'd given all they could. And despite their orders to stick it out at all costs, several reluctantly begin to fall back through the wood.
Yeah. Orders aren't. There's no point giving orders if you don't give the resources to support those orders. And defend at all costs. They needed more men, didn't they?
And in addition, sniping was also a terrible threat. And once more, you're going to be Private Frank Marilia.
We set up our Lewis gun with tragic results. In succession, 10 of my mates were killed, and it looked as if my own turn was next. Whilst at the gun, one bullet grazed the side of my face near the eye. Another hit the stock, but the bullets were not coming from the direction our gun was facing. After our 10th comrade had been killed, one of our chaps thought he saw a slight movement in a tree some distance to our rear. We gave the tree a burst, and out dropped a German sniper. A brave man. He must have crept into the wood in the blackness of the previous night and set himself up, well hidden, in the branches. I'm sure he would have known that his chances of survival were very slight. I was indeed lucky not to be his next victim. He certainly was. Wow. Now, what situation do you... Well, what do you think... How do you think the lads are feeling, the South Africans in that wood?
Right, well, they're going to be totally knackered. They're going to be exhausted. They're probably running out of food and water.
Because the shell fire would disrupt the ration system, the carrying parties.
Absolutely. And they're probably going to be increasingly shell-shocked.
Are they in deep trenches, do you think, by
this time? No, they're clinging on to what would be makeshift shallow trenches. And as each hour passes, there are fewer men left standing to face the next German counterattack.
Now, Captain Medlicott and his men, they're finally overrun by the Germans at dawn on the 19th of July. And you're going to be Captain RFC Medlicott of the 3rd Battalion South African Regiment, Transvaal and Rhodesia.
Exhausted machine gun ammunition, drove off tack from the wood, but had to chuck it soon after 8 a.m. Handed back, sorry to say, all German prisoners captured during the day. I got not a wink of sleep for 4 nights. Could not sleep in the night of the 18th. Got Lieutenants Gard and Thomas in a safe place, both wounded, with German prisoners. I was satisfied at our marksmanship. So many dead Germans round us in the wood. I was too busy waiting for the moment to attack, which was maturing during the day. The enemy shellfire was chiefly 5.9 inch, too intense to think of retiring. The Germans were rattled with our gunfire. Our men, who at that time, owing to want of water and sleep, were cold and stiff, were calm and had a don't-care-a-damn appearance.
Now, by the end, Colonel Thackeray and the scattered remnants of the 3rd South African, 3rd Battalion South African Regiment, they're just clinging onto their fingertips, just to a little tiny corner of the wood. And they promised, time and time again, they promised, more assistance is on the way. Has it come?
No. Nothing came at all. On the 19th of July, when the remnants of the South African Brigade finally emerged from what remained of the wood, there were only 780 of the 3,153 men present to answer the roll call.
Now, they're all dead. Most of them would be wounded of those casualties, but a lot of them are dead, far too many. And the South Africans would never forget that wood. So what should we look at next? What do you fancy?
Well, next, let's have a look at the attacks of
As if it's not written down in front of us on our notes.
Yeah, well, we'll look at the attacks by the 1st and 2nd Anzac Division, which is the attacks on Pozières and the Albert Bapaume Road.
Yeah, it's on that straight. Is it a Roman road? It looks like a Roman.
I think it is Roman road.
It goes from, well, would you say it goes from Albert to Bapaume?
Probably.
I'd say so. Sorry, I just got distracted by life. Now, this is Pozières, very strongly defended, isn't it? It's part of the original second line defence system, not line defence system. We keep emphasising this to give you an idea of how serious it all is.
Yeah, it was the original German second line, wasn't it?
Second line system, yeah. And it's up on Pozières Ridge. Important tactically, would you say?
Yeah, very important tactically, as it's captured not only to some extent destabilises the rest of the German second line system in that sector, but it also begins to unravel the German stranglehold on the fortress of the Thiepval Spur.
Now that's next to the Schwaben Redoubt. That's the what's that German expression that I can't pronounce?
The Schwerpunkt.
Now, that
still bars the way to any advance in the northern sector on the Somme battlefront.
And that's what Joffre had said they should just get on with and capture, because that is the key. If you capture that, then the Germans are going to have to fall back. Now, who's in charge of the Anzac divisions ultimately? Well,
ultimately, General Sir Hubert Gough is commanding what was then the Reserve Army and later known as the Fifth Army.
And who goes first?
Well, he decides to throw the newly arrived 1st Anzac Division into the fray. Oh, I wonder where they've arrived from, Pete.
Gallipoli land.
Now, they'd attack at 0030 on the 23rd of July. I never know how to say that.
No, you laughed at me when I had trouble with it the other day. How good it is to see you. So,
Half an hour past midnight on the 23rd of July, striking across from the southeast at the junction of the Reserve Army and 4th Army, rather than straight up the Albert-Pozières Road.
So coming at it slightly diagonally.
Yeah.
Now, you mentioned it. The 1st Australian Division, or is it Anzac? I think it's... I notice I keep changing. Anyway, they're fresh from Gallipoli. they're wasted endeavours, because I've been unwavering in my opinion that was a waste of resources. But do you think they had any idea what they were going to face on the Western Front?
No, I mean, we have mentioned before that, you know, what would be a huge barrage in Gallipoli was a minor skirmish on the Western Front. So for the first time, they're being exposed to the reality of warfare on the Western Front.
Just the sheer power of the guns, the number of the guns, the amount of ammunition available. They had hardly any ammunition at Gallipoli. So they're supporting British artillery. That's pounding to buggery the ruins of Pozières.
Pounding to buggery.
It's a technical expression used in the army. From the 19th of July. And it, that goes on for the 4 days before the attack at half past midnight. On 23rd of July. The Australians, there's a creeping barrage. And tell me, how do the Australians show a refreshing original, well, not originality particularly, but they're brave about how they do it, aren't they?
Yeah, about midnight, the Australians move up out to their jumping off tapes, and many of them creep out into no man's land so as to get as close as possible to the barrage line when it fell. Now, in doing so, they're accepting the risk of casualties from shells that drop even as much as a few yards short.
So at 12:28, there's the final mass barrage, and the Australians must have been amazed. And you're going to be Sergeant Harry Preston of the 9th Australian Battalion.
Down came our barrage onto the enemy line and Pozieres village, the Germans replying with artillery and machine gun fire. As we lay out among the poppies in no man's land, we could see the bullets cutting off the poppies almost against our heads. The flashes of the guns, the bursting of the shells and the very lights made the night like day. And as I lay as flat to the ground as possible, I was expected to stop one at any time, jamming my tin helmet down on my head. I brought the body of my rifle across my face to stop anything that might happen to drop low. In the tumult, it was impossible to hear orders. My ears were ringing with the cracking of bullets. A man alongside me was crying like a baby, and although I tried to reassure him, he kept on saying that we would never get out of it. Suddenly, I saw men scrambling to their feet. Taking this to be the signal for the charge, I jumped up and dashed across.
Now, I find that an excellent quote. It really gives the feeling. Now, one thing that would happen is that they then came under, besides the artillery, German artillery, heavy machine gun fire. Now, what's the difference between being under machine gun fire on the Somme and at Gallipoli? You've been to Anzac, Anzac Cove. Why would a machine gun be more of a threat at...
Well, because you're in relatively open fields on the Somme battlefield. We described in the earlier podcasts the way you have these sweeping hills and valleys of the Somme, but it's wide open. That means you can get enfilade fire,
and a long way,
and that is murderous.
And crisscrossing.
Yeah, absolutely.
And what's different about Anzac? Surely could they not do that there?
No, because it's very steep hills, it's cliffs. The land is very rugged. They're not wide open spaces at all.
You don't have the field of fire. It's short range deadliness, but it is deadly, but it's different, isn't it? Now, so 0 hour came. Hat out if anyone. People always blow the whistles. I'm not sure many people had heard. And the men move forward as best they can. The bombardment was pretty effective, and they forced their way into Pozieres Trench. That bars the way into the village of Pozieres. And again, you're going to be Sergeant Harry Preston.
At the point where I entered, there was a German doctor who afterwards did good work among the wounded. Private Jack Rogers, who reached a trench with me, bayoneted two Germans, and after a sharp fight, the trench was cleared and we immediately set to work to improve our position. Captain S.N. Lawrence was in charge of this work. The trench was in good order, with dugouts let into the sides. The dead bodies, which had to be thrown out, were used in building up the parapet.
Something they got used to doing at Gallipoli. That's a real feature of Gallipoli fighting, isn't it? Now, the fighting's particularly vicious. It really is horrible. Again, you're Sergeant Harry Preston.
I was with a party that was ordered to the right in an endeavour to force a way into the stronghold. This, however, proved difficult, as it was strongly held by the enemy, whose egg bombs could be thrown farther than our mills. After a sharp fight, our bomb supply ran out, and we were forced to barricade the trench and rely on rifle and bayonet until more grenades arrived. Men were spread out along the trench, and the bombs were passed from man to man. The Germans at first tricked us by putting helmets and caps on their rifles and walking along with them held above the parapet. When our men put their heads up and attempted to shoot them, they were shot by other Germans further along the trench.
Swines.
But it did not take us very long to wake up to this ruse, and very soon we were playing the same game. While all this was going on, and we were tunnelling under a road into the strong post, and by this means we succeeded in getting into the enemy trench. This movement startled the Germans, who dashed out and across the ridge towards Pozieres village, making an excellent target for our rifles and machine guns. In the meantime, other Australians had entered Pozieres and driven out its garrison, who were making their way to the stronghold. So out over the top we went and chased the confused and panic-stricken enemy over the ridge in the direction of the old windmill. A good many were overtaken and shot or bayoneted.
Now that windmill's still there. It's next to an absolutely ludicrous, I don't know if it's pets at war or bunny rabbits at war, sort of thing that's been placed next to it. But the windmill is a great site to visit, and I always like to go there. And I still remember when I took a group of... there for it was Matt McLaughlin. I took a group and I was saying, and over there is Mooncake Farm, pointing off across the open fields. And then I noticed Chris Baker was with a lone Australian, and Chris just gestured with his hand and just moved me round to where I was pointing to the right place, other than the 30 degrees out I was, because I'm not a SOM expert, as you know more about the Somme than
well,
I do.
And it's fair to say that the windmill isn't there. The ruins of
the
windmill.
Oh, no, it's just
there.
A mound, isn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, it's just a mound. And the Mooncake Farm that's there is the rebuilt Mooncake Farm.
Yeah, and it's invisible, yeah. Or it's just out there. But I had the direction wrong. And it,
it's not like you.
There's lots of pictures of me pointing on battlefields with Bulent, the Turkish guy, pointing in completely the different direction. Well, so where are we? I've forgotten where we
are.
Well,
what it means is the capture of most of the village means that the consolidation was the priority as they awaited the inevitable violent German reaction. Now, once they realised the situation, the German artillery, it wasn't idle, but
it's blasting them, isn't it?
It took a steady toll of the Australians. It isolated them.
What do you mean? What's it? Tell me how. So it's isolating. What does the isolation mean?
Well, they're trying to cut them off from reinforcement and basic supplies.
Food, you mentioned ammunition, earlier. Bombs.
Yeah. Now, this tactic was obvious, and it was expected, but almost impossible to counter without a concerted prior attempt to knock out the German batteries. And you're going to be Captain J.R.O. Harris.
Three initials.
Yeah, must all have a meaning, Pete. Of the 3rd Australian Battalion.
As fast as one portion of the trench was cleared, another was blown in. There were no dugouts in which men on post could take shelter, and the only thing to do was grin and bear it. The men who were not wounded were kept busy digging out the men who were buried alive by the explosions caving in the trench sides. I had occasion to bless my tin hat, for in our portion of the trench, the parapet was composed of the debris of a ruined house, and a shell pushed over a barrow load of bricks onto my head, with no other ill effect but some bruises on the shoulders. You've got a bruise on your shoulder today, haven't you? Well, yeah. Could you just tell them what happened to you, Gary? Because I found it quite interesting.
No, Pete.
Gary, come on.
No, Pete.
What happened to you?
No,
you
Pete.
Fell over in the shower, didn't you? Old man's trouble.
Something like that, Peter. Now, there's nothing for the survivors to do but endure as best they can. And you're going to be, once more, you're going to be Private Frank Brent of the 2nd Australian Battalion.
I think this is the first time I've been him, actually, Gary.
It is the first time you've been him, but I'm just trying to move on from the unfortunate shower incident.
The affair de shower.
Yeah. Now, Private Frank Brent, what does he say, Pete?
Without doubt, Pozieres was the heaviest, bloodiest, rottenest stunt that ever the Australians were caught up in. The carnage is just indescribable. As we were making our attack after the 3rd Brigade had gone through, we were literally walking over the dead bodies of our cobbers that had been slain by this barrage. I can't imagine anything more concentrated than the artillery barrage of the Germans at that particular stunt. He was even shelling our front line with great coal boxes. His artillery was registered right smack on it. The bay on our left went in. Two or three chaps were killed. The bay on our right went in. I said to this chap, "It's our turn next." He seems to be from Lancashire. I hadn't said it before we were buried. I was quite unconscious, buried in what had been the German frontline trench. I was picked up and sent back to the battalion first aid post. I was given a bottle of sal volatile. Is that how you pronounce it? Sal volatile. Or something. Oh, wish it had been rum. I was sat in the corner of this aid post for a little while, but then the wounded just streamed in, and the chap in charge of the post said, "Ah, well, you've had enough rest, you'd better get back again." And I went back. During the whole of that period, I can't remember anything more nerve-wracking than the continuous shelling day and night. This is what we mean. They've never had this in Gallipoli. Nothing, even an inkling of it. And what about, what do you do under shell fire? I mean, what would you do? Well, you're in your trench, the shell fire. What would you do?
Well, you try and move out of the way. And
which way, Gary?
Well, it wouldn't matter whether they move left or right. They couldn't second guess the random machinations of high technology.
Machinations.
And
you mean if the bloke twiddles his little knob?
If he twiddles his little knob and the degrees are set, then blind fate guides the shell to their final resting place. And that could be where you've just moved to.
Or it could be that you've moved out of the way.
Absolutely.
Of it. So it's nerve-wracking. And that must be one of the causes, because extreme stress is one of the causes of shell shock, isn't it?
Yeah. And this is going on and on and on. And at 8:30 on the 25th of July, the long-expected major counterattack.
German counterattack.
Yeah, it at last materialises from the direction of the windmill further along Pozieres Ridge. And this, once more, is Sergeant Harry Preston of the 9th Australian Battalion.
You like him,
don't you? I do. As I happened to be on the right flank, I found myself right in the thick of it. The enemy came over the ridge like swarms of ants rushing from shell hole to shell hole. Our men, full of fight and confidence, lined the parapet and emptied magazine after magazine into them. Some of the boys, anxious to get a shot at the Germans, pulled one another down from the fire step in the midst of the fight. Under this fire, and that of our machine guns and the artillery, which tore great gaps in the advancing lines, the enemy attack withered. The survivors were later seen retiring beyond the ridge, which was barraged by our artillery.
So this is why the German... When people say that, it's ridiculous, the British, the Allies must have suffered terribly more than the Germans. The Germans, some people have worked out the Germans attack as much as we do. This is two huge armies smashing hell out of each other.
And they're caught in the open in that case because, you know, they are attacking... against a defended position, the artillery are going to rip them to pieces.
Now, the Australian lines hold against this attack and they're eventually relieved by the 2nd Australian Division. By then, they'd lost over 5,000 casualties, which must have been... The Australians too suffered dreadfully on Pozieres Ridge. Gough, he's undeterred. He was always a vigorous commander, not one of our favourites, is he? But he's determined enough, and he's determined to drive through Pozieres as soon as possible. And so who does he send up?
Well, partly in consequence, the 2nd Australian Division was inveigled into launching an attack without adequate preparation.
Oh, that's bad. It's always bad. No chance to find out where they're going. So what time?
I wonder why you're asking me to say. So at 00:15 on the 29th of July, so quarter past midnight, the 7th Australian Brigade attacked the OG1 and OG2 lines.
Which I think we discovered before is our name, Old German 1 and Old German 2. I said that was an original of the Germans to call it that. But of course it's us that's calling it.
Yeah, we're calling it.
I was thinking, when I listened to that podcast, I thought, you're an idiot, Pete.
And then towards the Pozieres windmill that lay beyond them. So a stretcher bearer is watching the doomed advance of the proud Anzacs of the 28th Battalion, and you're going to be Private Tom Young of the 27th Australian Battalion.
They marched across No Man's Land as if they were on the parade ground, with their own shells screaming in droves over their heads and the German shells blowing them to bits. The men dropped like flies. The German wire remained intact, and they could go neither forward nor back. They tore at the barbed wire with their hands, searching for openings under one of the most intense machine gun barrages Australians have ever faced. So they're just trapped in front. This is the old hanging on the old barbed wire, in front of thick German barbed wire. So what do the survivors do?
Well, they've got little or no choice, and most of them take shelter in shell holes.
That's the only blessing there. The ground is starting to be cratered. And you're going to be Corporal Percy Blythe of the 28th Australian Battalion.
We left a long line of the best and bravest boys that Australia ever produced lying along that wire. Some fell across it with the wires in their hands. Others died with the wire cutters still on the wire. But they were glorious lads, every one of them. I got into a shell hole right under his wire and could go no further forward. So I sent my supply of bombs in the direction of his machine gun right in front of me. I cannot vouch for the result, but this time everything was in a state of chaos, and I took the risk of going from shell hole to shell hole, trying to get the boys together for another try. The word came up for us to withdraw to our original front line. They all did this, but I stayed and did my best for several wounded fellows.
Now, they made a few trivial gains, but most of the 7th Brigade, they just end up back in their jumping off trenches. The casualties were sobering. How many did the 28th Battalion that we've just been talking about, how many did they lose?
They lost about 467 men.
That's terrible. Now, they make two attacks in all, and then the battered 2nd Australian Division finally pulled back on the 6th of August, by which time how many casualties?
Well, by that time they'd suffered about 6,800 casualties over the two attacks.
They finally got the crest of Pozieres Ridge. They'd secured a tactically valuable vista. It stretches over the Pozieres Ridge towards Courcelles, Martin Puys, towards Bapaume along the road. They're pulled back and the 4th Australian Division comes in. Is that the end of the fight for the Australians?
No. We're going to leave them there, but the fight actually goes on, Pete.
Yeah, the Reserve Army, the 5th Army, would batter its way forward on the Pozieres Ridge, edging towards Mouquet Farm. That's the very thing I was talking about. How would you describe the process for the Australians on that ridge?
Well, two steps forward and one step back. It might well have exaggerated the speed of the
advance. You mean it wasn't that quick?
It wasn't that quick. The fighting was so hotly contested.
This is attrition, isn't it?
Yeah. Now, it's evident it's descended into attritional battle of the worst kind. The constant barrages of the British guns were gradually grinding away at the bedrock of the German army.
Yes, because this is what we forget. The Germans, not only are they making their own counterattacks, but they are exposed time and time again to incredible barrages by British guns. Feeling their way all round the German lines, constantly causing a trickle of casualties. And in a big barrage, they'd cause a lot of casualties, wouldn't they? But there's something wrong with the British attacks. What would you describe? I'm not impressed by British generalship during this phase.
No, it's possibly incompetent, and it's often uncoordinated tactics mean that when they went into attack, that they were losing men whole scale to achieve practically nothing.
So both sides are getting a complete hammering. Both sides are losing terrible casualties and no end in sight, really.
Well, while the Australians are being so brutally introduced to the horrors of the Western Front in July and August, the 4th Army Front had once more embarked on a difficult period of trying to seize a string of local objectives that would serve to ease and prepare the ground ready for the next big assault on the integrity of the whole German line, which was going to be made on the 15th of September. And
that's the Battle of Flers-Courcelette.
It is the Battle of Flers-Courcelette.
Now, this reminds me of the period before the 14th of July. And we discussed that. Lots of little battalion or smaller attacks that are on a narrow front. They're not properly supported by a proper barrage.
Well, preparation's a double-edged sword, isn't it? It's got pros and cons. You've got time to prepare for an assault, but that means there's time for the Germans to repair and prepare their own defences. Time to bring up fresh divisions and more gun batteries to duel with the British artillery for the control of the battlefield. Yet, if you attack without proper preparation, Pete, it simply guarantees defeat.
It does. You're going to get properly smash, and that happened time and time again. It is not a great period of British generalship. This isn't directly related, by the way, to the very top. This is generalship throughout. Both Gough and Rawlinson lose control of the battle. They fail to exert grip. And in the background, Haig's actually slamming into Rawlinson, telling him to get a grip.
So you mean the general generalship?
Yes.
So what's the next big battle, Pete?
Well, We're flitting across the battle. I want people to realise that these are just three highlights we've picked, or lowlights, to be absolutely honest. The next one is the attack on the 9th of September, which was to be made by the 16th, that's the Irish division, on the benighted village of Ginchy. Now, you're going to be a real character in this. Lieutenant Tom Kettle. Who's Lieutenant? Tell me a bit about yourself, Gary.
Well, he was a prominent Irish nationalist MP. He was born in Dublin in 1880. He was a leading intellectual and was elected the first president of the Young Ireland branch of the United Irish League. And he later became editor of the nationalist newspaper. Now, in 1906, his burgeoning political career culminated in his victory in the East Tyrone seat for the House of Commons. Now, his life changes when he was in Belgium on a mission to purchase rifles for the Republican Volunteers in 1914.
Legal?
No, that's highly illegal, Pete.
So, basically, this man is what we call, not IRA, but he is a Republican, and by nature, he's on the revolutionary side.
Yeah,
purchasing rifles.
He was, but caught up in the outbreak of war, he's actually soon repulsed by witnessing the brutality of the German army.
Ah, he's in Belgium.
He's in Belgium, and he firmly identified with the invaded Belgian, whose position he compared to Ireland. And in the end, despite his republicanism, he enlists in the British Army.
So this is a case of an Irish nationalist who considers that the German army, the Germans, posed the bigger threat. So, British bad, Germans worse.
Yeah. Now, during his service, he gains a kind of hope for the future of Ireland from the shared experience of Protestants and Catholics within the 16th and 36th Ulster Divisions.
Now, 16th is essentially Catholic, and 36th, Ulster Division. So they're the Red Hand gang.
Yes.
Well, I know they've got a red hand on the divisional side. I wasn't...
I just wondered where you were going with that.
So is it fair to say that Protestant Catholics don't always get on?
Yeah, it is fair to say. And you know, it's not overestimating to say that, you know, Tom Kettle held his beliefs firmly as a Republican. Now, I'm going to be Lieutenant Tom Kettle of the 9th Royal Dublin Fusiliers, and he says this: had I lived, I had meant to call my next book on the relations of Ireland and England, The Two Fools, A Tragedy of Errors. It has needed all the folly of England and all the folly of Ireland to produce a situation in which our unhappy country is now involved. I have mixed much with Englishmen and with Protestant Ulstermen, and I know that there is no real or abiding reason for the gulfs, saltier than the sea, that now dismember the natural alliance of both of them with us Irish nationalists. It needs only a fiat lux of
I don't know what that means.
Of a kind very easily compassed.
Do you know what he means by that?
No, but it's interesting that he uses the words of a kind very easily compassed, which suggests a direction or pointing to replace the unnatural with the natural. In the name and by the seal of the blood given in the last 2 years, I ask for colonial home rule for Ireland, a thing essential in itself and essential as a prologue to the reconstruction of the empire. Ulster will agree. Ulster will agree, and I ask for the immediate withdrawal of martial law in Ireland and an amnesty for all Sinn Féin prisoners. If this war has taught us anything, it is that great things can be done only in a great way.
Now, so he sees a hope for the future in the way that the two sides in the Ireland dispute, or the three sides, because there are three sides at least, have sort of come together and can mix and have a common project. He's an intellectual, isn't he? He's a man of letters. How do you think he gets on well? How does he think he gets on with the lads? Does he get on well with them? Sorry, I can't speak.
Yeah, I think he sees them as having good spirits and enduring, you know, the hardships that they face. And I think, you know, he genuinely feels a real respect and love for his men.
And I think this shows in the next quote you've got from Tom Kettle.
The bombardment, destruction and bloodshed are beyond all imagination. Nor did I ever think the valour of simple men could be quite so beautiful as that of my Dublin Fusiliers. I have had two chances of leaving them, one on sick leave and one to take a staff job. I've chosen to stay with my comrades. I'm calm and happy, but desperately anxious to live.
This is quite sad, isn't it? I remember looking it up. He just had a baby daughter born a couple of days before. She's called Betty. I looked her up. In fact, I looked up when she died for when I was writing my son book in 2005-06. He never saw her because she was born. He was away. What happens to Kettle?
Well, he's hit very early in the attack, and it is witnessed, in fact. And you're going to be Second Lieutenant Emmett Dalton of the 9th Royal Dublin Fusiliers.
I was with Tom when we advanced to the position that night, and the stench of the dead that covered our road was so awful that we both used some foot powder on our faces. When we reached our objective, we dug ourselves in, and then at 5 p.m. on the 9th, we attacked Ginchy. I was just behind Tom when we went over the top. He was in a bent position and a bullet got over a steel waistcoat that he wore and entered his heart. Well, he only lasted about 1 minute and he had my crucifix in his hands. He also said, "This is the 7th anniversary of my wedding." I forgot whether 7th or 8th. I love the last touch of the memory there. But I remember I found this all very touching. It's just one of many. But he is seen as... That bullet, it doesn't just kill Tom Kettle, does it? Because he did have his hopes for a peaceful solution to the Irish problem. Do you think he was realistic about his hopes?
We'll never know. We will never know. That bullet took away any possibility.
It certainly did. His body was never recovered, and he's on the Tietval Memorial. I think I might see if I can see that next time I'm there. Let's carry on. So what happens to these poor Irish lads attacking? You're going to be Second Lieutenant Arthur Young of the 7th Royal Irish Fusiliers.
Our shells, bursting in the village of Ginchy, made it belch forth smoke like a volcano. We couldn't run. We advanced at a steady walking pace, stumbling here and there, but going ever onward and upward. A shell landed in the midst of a bunch of men about 70 yards away on my right. I have a most vivid recollection of seeing a tremendous burst of clay and earth go shooting up into the air. Yes, and even parts of human bodies. And that, when the smoke cleared away, there was nothing left.
Now, they went on against what's officially described, i.e. the official history, I presume I mean by that, as slight opposition. They overrun the German front line and burst through the Ginchy. Much left of Ginchy, do you think, by this time?
No, it's rubble and powder, to be frank.
Yeah, pinky brick dust, they often describe these things as. So how are they going to consolidate?
Well, they do eventually manage to consolidate. Now, alongside them were the 1st 6th Connaught Rangers, who are commanded by Colonel Roland Fielding, who had only just taken over command of the battalion, which had already suffered some really severe casualties. Now, you're going to be Lieutenant Colonel Roland Fielding of the 1st 6th Connaught Rangers.
I always think he's a chap who can't spell his own name. Every time I see it, I think. And he wrote a wonderful book. Is it Letters to a Wife? It's a cracking book. And this is him. The trench in front of us, hidden and believed innocuous, which had in consequence been more or less ignored in the preliminary artillery programme, had, perhaps for this very reason, developed as the enemy's main resistance. This, in fact, being believed to be the easiest section of the attack, had been allotted to the tired and battered 47th Brigade. Such are the surprises of war. Supplemented by machine gun nests in shell holes, the trench was found by the few who reached close enough to see into it to be a veritable hornet's nest. Moreover, it had escaped our bombardment altogether, or nearly so. Now, this is... You're going to be now... I loved when I interviewed a chap called Second Lieutenant Francis Jourdain. He never used the word. He was always just his initials. He's also first sixth Connacht Rangers. And I remember interviewing him somewhere. Well, I still remember the walk to his house from the train station. And he died during the interview. Not while I was there, but before it was finished. But we finished the First World War part. He was a very bright lad. Very bright. And he was a very bright 90-odd-year-old when I saw him. Now, you're going to be him. And this is where we get a wonderful connection between him and Fielding, whose book a lot of us... First World War enthusiasts are people interested in, have got that book. So go, Gary, be Second Lieutenant Francis.
When the battle started, it was all very horrifying. Shells shooting over the trench, knocking the sand of the parapet. The troops went forward, and they very soon came back. They were really knocked to bits by the Germans. I did not take part in the actual movement, because it wasn't my business to do so. I was the signal officer, and I was in the front line trench looking after whatever signal communications there were, D3 telephone and lines which kept on being broken. The only useful communication was back to brigade. I had one or two NCOs and soldiers with me trying to keep a line going down the communications trench. One single wire on which everything depended. That kept on being bombarded, and the thing got cut, and several brave men kept on mending it. The whole thing developed into some glorious muddle, and there wasn't anything very coherent sent back. In the middle of the battle, the adjutant decided to go sick with trench fever. He retired from the war, in fact, and was never seen again, which was not a very good thing for an adjutant to do in the middle of a battle. Fielding, who took a certain liking to me, thought I was reasonably intelligent and made me the adjutant on the spot. I was, militarily speaking, of no height and only 18. The point was I was there. The thing finished as a shambles.
Now, and he's mentioned in the book. His efforts are very much appreciated. He is a very bright lad. Fielding says Jourdain had wisdom far beyond his years. And found he did remarkably well under pressure. He says again, Fielding says, the boy Jourdain is still acting adjutant and is doing marvellously well in spite of his extreme youth. And I think it's absolutely fascinating. And later on, he becomes a staff officer. And we've actually mentioned him in quotes on the on 1918, where he ends up as a staff officer, a divisional staff officer. And one memorable day, forgot to send the food rations forward. But the men under him never complained, Gary.
No, well, they wouldn't. Now, in some ways, the study of August and early September is the least rewarding and most utterly depressing chapter in the whole tragic epic of the Somme offensive. The Brits...
Why?
Well, the British had the troops, they had the guns, the ammunition and even the weather. The perpetual enemy of British generals...
You mean it always snows or rains when we...
Was reasonably favourable, yeah. Now, yet the period went by unredeemed by anything that could be considered a success, just thousand upon thousands more casualties.
Well, I'm not sure if I agree with myself in one sense. I am arguing with myself, but I would point out that we are killing a lot of Germans, which is, I suppose, the point. But it could have been done better, couldn't it? I think this is the point that... The lessons of the 14th of July, massed bombardments, short massed hurricane bombardments, surprise attacks, flexible infantry tactics, these have been ignored, haven't they? And is it anyone's fault? It's so distracting. It's difficult to keep a grip, and that's what Rawlinson fails to do. And Gough, they fail to keep a grip.
No, there was.
And Haig fails to keep a grip on them. Let's not beat about the bush. And is Haig beating about the wrong bush anyway? In fact, they should have been going direct for Schwaben Redoubt and Thiepval Ridge. So in my view, this is not a great period of British generalship.
No, and there were some notable successes. You know, a few German trenches and strong points are captured.
Yeah,
but
what
then
happens?
They're replaced by new ones that blossomed just behind the German front line.
OG2. So they just dig new ones, don't they?
Yeah, and it seems like there's no end in sight. And
are they as good as the ones, the trenches that...
Well, they won't be because they haven't had the time. And I shouldn't imagine that the British artillery leave them in peace to do this.
No, that's true. Now, so there's one quote that I remember that that really sums up how people were feeling. And it's a depressing quote, and we're going to finish on this one, aren't we? You've got a couple of comments to make at the end, but who am I going to be?
You're going to be Captain Philip Pilditch of C Battery, 235 Brigade, Royal Field Artillery.
I am afraid we are settling down to siege warfare in earnest and of a most sanguinary kind. Very far from my hopes, our hopes in July. But it's always the same. Festubert, Loos, and now this. Both sides are too strong for a finish yet. God knows how long it will be at this rate. None of us will ever see its end. And children still at school will have to take over. Now, I thought that was brilliant. But it's also triggered a memory for you.
Yeah, when we went to Verdun and I did a stand, I passed around a postcard. It was a French postcard. And we'll put this up, I think, because it showed babies and it was the class of 37, I think. And the inference was that the war was going to go on so long that there were children as yet unborn who would be necessary to fill the depleted ranks. And it that just resonated with me with that last comment.
And, of course, those children would be at war, but it would be the Second World War.
It would.
Now, so this not a lot of good cheer about this week's episode. Our loyal and loving listenership must be feeling quite depressed.
Well, most of them are that way after any of our podcasts, Pete.
Oh yeah. Well, luckily we've got our book coming out. Well, we've been working on our book, Laugh or Cry. And there's a couple of episodes coming up which are based on recruitment, training, and which I hope will cheer you up a bit. Anyway, Gary, I'm sorry that you've had your terrible accident this morning in the shower, and I hope your shoulder gets better soon.
Thanks, Pete. Cheers.
Cheers.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Thanks for listening. Follow us on Twitter and Facebook to learn more about each episode. And if you'd like to support the podcast, you have a couple of options. You can buy us a coffee at buymeacoffee.com/PGMH, or consider subscribing to the podcast for only £2 per month and get ad-free listening and bonus content. You can find links for both on our Facebook and Twitter accounts.
Sounds great, doesn't it?